tracking tool, how physical education works in a virtual learning environment, how One Oklahoma Theater is staying open during the pandemic, candy shoots could save Halloween during the coronavirus pandemic, how do you make people laugh during a pandemic? And this year's pecan crop is strong, but growers are having to adjust to a very different market. We'll get to those stories. First, we'll bring you the numbers. The Odessa American Day today is reporting Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, at 5,219. Ector County negative, 23,793 out of 29,343 tested, with 331 pending, 101 deaths. Recovered, 4,372. Active, 746. ECISD daily cases, 1 student, 3 staff. Midland County, 4,080 confirmed, 85 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, average new cases increased by 32 compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 8th, 3,786 new cases were reported. Hospitalizations increased by 366 patients compared with a week ago. As of October 8th, 3,556 Texans are hospitalized for the coronavirus. Average new deaths decreased by 6 deaths compared with the 7-day average a week ago. On October 8th, 104 new deaths were reported. And West Texas Intermediate today is trading at $41.06, down 13 cents. One other quick note. In just a moment, we'll be bringing you some new polling numbers in Texas regarding the presidential race, regarding the senatorial race, and also Governor Abbott's handling of the coronavirus. But first, let's go to coronavirus briefs. Speaking to Fox News' Sean Hannity on Thursday night, President Trump, who paused to clear his throat and cough, said he probably would get tested again for the virus today, but he did not say when the last test took place. The CDC's ensemble forecast projects there will be 224,000 to 233,000 coronavirus deaths in the U.S. by October 31st. At least 212,000 people have died of the coronavirus in the United States since February. More than 7,568,000 cases have been reported. The world has recorded its highest number of daily COVID-19 cases since the pandemic began, fueled by a second wave in Europe. President Trump has been cleared by his doctor to resume public engagements, but there are still some unanswered questions about his health. President Trump, who is still recovering from COVID-19, said he will not participate in the next debate with Joe Biden after the commission said it will be held virtually. The Biden campaign rejected Trump's demand to delay each of the next two debates a week. More than a dozen people close to the Trump administration or his campaign have contracted coronavirus in recent days. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans plan to press ahead on Monday with nomination hearings for the president's Supreme Court nominee, Amy Coney Barrett. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said Thursday that he has avoided the White House for months because of the lax attitude toward face masks and social distancing. Health officials are asking anyone who works in the White House to get tested for the coronavirus, as staffers question why some people who may have been exposed still haven't been notified by contact tracers. A senior Marine has tested positive for the coronavirus. It's the second high-ranking uniformed official this week to do so. Broadway has suspended shows through May 2021. Only two U.S. states are reporting declines in new COVID-19 cases. Here's a look at where infections are rising. The U.S. on Thursday reported the most cases it has seen in a single day in nearly 2 months. More than 56,000 new cases were added yesterday, according to Johns Hopkins University. Meanwhile, only two states are showing a downward trend, Hawaii and Alabama. At least 28 states are showing upward trends, and 20 states are holding steady. Hong Kong researchers will test dual flu coronavirus vaccine. Researchers in Hong Kong are poised to begin human trials of an experimental vaccine for both the novel coronavirus and influenza, Bloomberg News reported. The dual vaccine candidate will be delivered to participants in the form of a nasal spray, similar to those already being used to immunize people against the flu. Scientists hope to trigger an immune response in the nose's mucous membrane. Our idea is that we want both influenza and COVID-19 protection at the same time, Yen Kwok Young, a professor at the University of Hong Kong, told Bloomberg News. Early stage trials are slated to begin next month and will enroll roughly 100 volunteers. The experimental vaccine is one of dozens in development around the world, but appears to be the first that would also offer protection against the flu. Public health experts around the world have warned that this year's winter flu season could collide with the coronavirus pandemic, overwhelming hospitals. Since the two viruses often have similar symptoms, determining which illness is afflicting a patient could prove challenging, bogging down testing facilities. Now, here are those numbers that I teased about a few moments ago from the Texas Tribune. These are polls from UT and the Texas Tribune. First, Donald Trump leads Joe Biden by 5 points in Texas. The president leads the former vice president 50-45%. Here's a breakdown. The Republicans, Trump and his running mate, Vice President Mike Pence, had strong support from white, 62%-34%, and male voters, 55%-39%. While Joe Biden and Kamala Harris are the favorites of female, 51%-46%, black, 87%-11%, and Hispanic, 54%-37% of voters in Texas. Despite the dramatic swings in events and issues during 2020, the contest for the hearts and minds of Texas voters has changed little in the race for the nation's top elected office. The latest poll is a case in point. The survey was conducted during a period that included the first presidential debate and Trump's hospitalization for COVID-19. Even so, the result is in line with previous UTTT surveys. In February, the UTTT poll found Trump ahead of Biden 47%-43%. In April, Trump led 49%-44%, and in June, 48%-44%. The economy was the most important issue in Texas behind the presidential vote for 11% of voters and for 22% of independents asked to name the top issue behind their choice. It was also the top pick among Republicans, 15%, followed by socialism and or communism, the issue mentioned by 12% of Republican voters on that open-ended question. Among Democrats, 19% cited removing the president as their top issue, followed by coronavirus, 11%, and health care, 9%. Most voters have already made their final decisions. 91% said they are unlikely to change their minds before they vote. While Trump is 5 percentage points ahead of Biden in the head-to-head matchup, he comes up a bit short of what might be expected of a Republican on a Texas ballot. In a generic congressional race pitting an unnamed Republican against an unnamed Democrat, the poll found the Republican had a 7 percentage point advantage, 51%-44%, among Texas voters. In a generic race for the state legislature, a Republican would have an 8 percentage point edge, 51%-43%. And Republican John Cornyn, seeking re-election to the U.S. Senate, has an 8 percentage point lead over Democrat M.J. Hager in this poll, outperforming the president by 3 percentage points. We're not seeing the race open up in the way we're used to. Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Report at UT Austin, said. He said the independent voters in Texas who typically end up with Republicans, like they did in the Texas race for president 4 years ago, siding with Trump, are on Biden's side this year. The president lost independents in Texas a little while ago, and he hasn't gained them back, Blank said. That's affecting Republicans up and down the ballot. The president's job ratings from Texas voters have remained relatively constant over time. In the current poll, 49% of voters said they approve of the job he's been doing as president, while 46% disapprove. A year ago, 47% approved and 48% disapproved. In October 2017, 3 years ago, 45% approved and 50% disapproved. What looks like an even split disguises a deep partisan divide. 89% of Democrats disapprove of the president's job performance, while 90% of Republicans approve. Independent voters disapprove by a 53%-31% margin. When voters are asked about Trump's handling of the economy, his approval now, 52%, hasn't changed much since February when it was 50%. But more voters disapprove now. 42% than earlier this year, when 36% said they didn't like the way he was handling the economy. Voter responses were tied to their allegiances. 82% of Democrats and 49% of independents disapprove of the president's handling of the economy, while 91% of Republicans approve. Asked about the president's response to the pandemic, 45% of voters said they approve and 48% disapprove. And similar splits are evident in approval of the president's handling of race relations. Overall, 43% approve and 48% of Texans disapprove. On both topics, as with Trump's overall job rating and his rating on the economy, voters' ratings matched their partisan leanings. On the pandemic, 83% of Texas Republicans said the president is doing a good job, and 87% of Texas Democrats said he's not. On race relations, 78% of Republicans approve, 87% of Democrats disapprove. The University of Texas Texas Tribune Internet Survey of 1,200 registered voters was conducted from September 25th through October 4th and has an overall margin of error of plus or minus 2.83 percentage points. The margin of error for results from 908 likely voters is plus or minus 3.25 percentage points. And as that story mentioned previously, John Cornyn leads MJ Haggar by 8 points in the U.S. Senate race. Now, here are the polling results for Governor Abbott. Governor Abbott's ratings fell during the pandemic. As the pandemic dragged on in Texas, the distance between Abbott's approval and disapproval ratings from voters has narrowed. Governor Greg Abbott remains popular in Texas, but voters' latest assessment of his job performance reveals the cost of his responses to the coronavirus. The top lines are not bad. 47% of Texas registered voters approve of the governor's overall job performance, while 40% do not, a 7 percentage point spread. But in June, the spread was 10 percentage points. In April, it was 24 points, when the governor had just started reacting to the pandemic and had favorable ratings from 56% of voters and unfavorable ratings from 32%. 1 year ago, the governor's good grades were 24 points higher than his bad ones. 2 years ago, it was 20 percentage points. Voters' ratings of Abbott's COVID-19 response have also dropped. In April, at the beginning of the state government's response to the pandemic, 56% of Texas voters approved of Abbott's action, and 29% disapproved. Approval of his responses slid 12 percentage points since then, and disapproval rose by 17 points in the latest poll. 44% approved and 46% disapproved. Now, let's go to our reports. The first couple of reports are going to be focused more directly on the coronavirus and its treatments. The first one is from NPR. Could COVID-19 be treated by the drug the president is touting?
President Donald Trump today continued to tout an experimental treatment he received for COVID-19. Here he is in a video he posted on Twitter today.
We have medicines right now, and I call them a cure.
But is it a cure? And if so, how soon could it be available outside of experimental use? Here to explain, NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. And Richard, explain a little bit more about what this drug is that the president is excited about.
Hi, Audie. Yeah, the president received intensive medical care, including three significant drugs, but the one he credits his rapid recovery to is called a monoclonal antibody. In theory, it blocks the virus the way our own antibodies do once you develop immunity to a disease. It's an exciting concept, and two companies said they have experimental products up for review at the Food and Drug Administration.
The president is telling the public, though, that it'll be available really soon. Soon enough to help people, right, who are currently hospitalized with COVID-19. Is that true?
Well, first of all, it's most likely to be effective early in the disease, actually as a way to keep people out of the hospital. Yesterday, the chief scientific officer of Eli Lilly, Dr. Dan Skovronsky, told reporters that, you know, he's not expecting a snap decision about the emergency use application that the company submitted yesterday.
Adequate and deep scientific review inevitably takes time. We've submitted a lot of data to the agency, and our expectation is there will be a careful and thorough review.
And the FDA is not supposed to bend to political pressure from the president, but the agency is clearly feeling it at the moment.
The president's in his video said for the first time he was very sick last week, and now he says he's not contagious at all. What do we know about people who've been infected and how long they're considered infectious after the fact?
Health officials say people with mild to moderate illness should actually isolate for 10 days after their first symptoms to make sure that they are no longer infectious. Trump got sick 7 days ago, as far as we know, but, you know, he's also taking a steroid drug, and doctors say that could possibly extend the time that he could be infectious.
The president's doctor said that he has the antibodies to the coronavirus. What does that tell us about the course of the disease?
Well, nothing really, because it's likely those antibodies are the monoclonal antibodies that he was infused with, not the ones from his own immune system. Those antibodies probably persist for a few weeks, the synthetic ones. And immunobiologist Deepta Bhattacharya at the University of Arizona says there's a chance that the treatment could actually prevent people from developing their own immunity.
But would it work like a vaccine would? No way. I mean, there's no way that you'd mount the same level of a response that you would, you know, if you are left to the normal infection or whether you received a vaccine.
So we'll have to wait and see about that.
But if it's deemed safe and recommended, will there be even enough to go around, essentially?
Well, certainly not in the short run. Eli Lilly's hoping to have up to 1 million doses for worldwide use, though, by the end of the year. And the other company, Regeneron, is hoping to produce 50,000 doses. Dave Ricks, CEO of Lilly, says this isn't a competition.
We're rooting for Regeneron's success, as I'm sure they are for ours, because the main constraint here is manufacturing capacity. Neither company, plus all our partners, could produce enough for the world right now based on the incidence of the disease.
So that obviously leaves all sorts of questions about how to distribute it fairly, assuming it does end up on the market.
That's NPR's Richard Harris. Thank you so much.
Sure, Adi. Good to talk to you.
Now, from treatment to testing, this report asks, can the U.S. use its growing supply of rapid tests to stop the virus?
More than 7.2 million people have tested positive for the coronavirus in the U.S., and as health experts warn of a difficult winter ahead, they're also asking if the U.S. needs an entirely new testing strategy. A new generation of coronavirus tests that are faster and cheaper could make that possible. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein has been looking into this and joins us. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Rachel.
What would a new testing strategy mean?
Well, there's been a lot of buzz lately among public health experts about an entirely new way of thinking about testing. You know, until now, testing has been mainly used to diagnose people who may have COVID and to test people who had contact with an infected person to see if they caught the virus. Mm-hmm. But that just hasn't gotten the pandemic under control. So I talked about this with Ashish Jha. He's the dean of the Brown School of Public Health. He says this new generation of fast, cheap coronavirus tests could spark a paradigm shift in how testing is used in this country.
It is a paradigm shift. What I think new testing capacity allows us to do is actually play offense, go and hunt for the disease before it spreads, to identify asymptomatic people before they spread it to others. It really becomes about preventing outbreaks, not just capturing them after they've occurred.
You know, by regularly testing people like all nursing home residents and staff, every prison inmate and guard, firefighters, police, EMTs, teachers and other staff in K-12, university students.
So, I mean, cheaper, faster, that all sounds good. How accurate are the new tests?
So these new tests tend to be less accurate. They can produce more false negatives, you know, missing people when they really are infected, and more false positives, saying someone is infected when they're really not. But advocates say these tests tend to spot people when they're the most infectious, which is the most important thing. And any shortcomings are outweighed by the ability to quickly test people over and over and over again.
So, I mean, we've heard this for a long time, that you just need more tests. You got to test more people in order to catch it. But it's been a capacity issue, hasn't it, all along? I mean, how many of these tests would the U.S. need?
So, you know, Jha and a team at Harvard just completed a new analysis for NPR factoring in the growing availability of these new coronavirus tests. It concludes that at a bare minimum, the U.S. would need more than 4 million tests a day.
Do we have that?
So, you know, the new U.S. has never gotten above about 1 million tests a day, but these new fast tests, they're known as antigen tests, are becoming more widely available. The federal government just started sending 150 million of them to states. Again, the companies are ramping up to produce tens of millions of them. So by some estimates, the U.S. could maybe get there by the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Here's Dr. Thomas Tsai, one of the Harvard researchers working with Jia.
We've been holding our breath as a country for the last months, waiting for a new technology, waiting for more capacity for testing. But this is a moment for us to capitalize on the technology and lets us reopen parts of the economy and schools with confidence.
Now, it's important to remember that, 4 million is just the bare minimum. This new analysis also concludes that the U.S. needs way more than that, more than 14 million tests a day to do things like screen school kids and doctors and nurses and waiters and bartenders. But, there are some projections that U.S. testing capacity could ramp up, even more by next year. And that, so it's really important to figure out a good strategy to deploy these tests in the smartest way to make this new strategy really work.
NPR's Rob Stein, thank you.
You bet, Rachel.
Now here's a report about a former CDC director on how to restore faith in the agency.
Dr. William Foege, a former director of the CDC under both Republican and Democratic presidents, wrote a private letter to the current head, Dr. Robert Redfield. Someone from inside the CDC leaked it. And in it, Foege demonstrates empathy for Redfield, writing, "Dear Bob, I start each day thinking about the terrible burden you bear." But the letter focuses on his concern for the fate of the CDC and for the country, saying, quote, "The failure of the White House to put the CDC in charge has resulted in the violation of every lesson learned in the last 75 years that made the CDC the gold standard for public health in the world." When we spoke earlier today, I asked Foege to talk about his decision to write Redfield.
Dr. Redfield is the one person that could turn this around. And so what I was appealing for is for him to actually tell CDC employees who have gone through a terrible time of being denigrated by the White House, we are now going to come up with a national plan and I'll stand behind you. And I said to him in the letter that he would undoubtedly be fired, but he could leave with his head held high that he had done the right thing to try to correct the course of this pandemic.
You wrote that Robert Redfield has, quote, shown great resilience in being willing to take White House abuse. What should the role of the CDC director be in this current situation? I mean, how are you thinking he has failed to fulfill it?
We've had 75 years of experience at CDC on how to handle outbreaks and pandemics. And it appears to me that every one of those lessons has been violated. The first one is to know the truth. We do not know what the truth is. We end up going to journalists and to Johns Hopkins to find the truth, where we should be able to go to CDC. You have to have a national plan. You can't have 50 states trying to figure this out on their own. It felt to me like President Trump had his knee on the neck of the public health community, holding them down so that they could not actually do their work. You can't sit by and let this happen. I think often about the Survival at Auschwitz book by Primo Levi. He said, if you know how to prevent torture and don't do it, you become the torturer. This was the burden I found myself living under, that silence was complicity, and I had to do something, but I did not want to go public with it. I wanted to give Dr. Redfield a chance to turn this around on his own, and I think he still could.
I want to talk about that for a second. Beyond being sidelined, the CDC has made critical mistakes in the pandemic response in terms of the testing at the beginning, which really set the U.S. back in its ability to track the virus. These are costly mistakes. How do you think the CDC could have recovered from that?
Well, I think that it was a setback, but it wasn't a permanent setback. What was a permanent setback is the inability to actually develop a national plan. And the White House plan has not worked out at all. We got about the worst response to this pandemic that you could possibly have, and it's because CDC was not allowed to do the thing that they're trained to do.
You also write that the CDC's reputation has gone from gold to tarnished brass in this pandemic, that career scientists are fed up and thinking of leaving. Is there anything you think the CDC can do to stop, I guess, sliding into the failures you describe?
Well, that's a phrase I would not have used if I'd known this was going to go public. At 84 years of age, I'm always surprised at how naive I still am. What could they do? Well, the amazing thing is how good the workers still are at CDC. I presented last night with a CDC worker about the allocation of vaccine. The CDC worker was talking about their plans for actually delivering it. And I was astounded by how good those plans are. But they have this terrible political blanket over them that makes it difficult to do their scientific work.
What are they saying to you? Like you referenced that some employees or listservs you were on that people were talking.
Well, you can imagine how disheartening it is to write up recommendations for what should be done in a situation, only to have the White House change those recommendations. And then they have to walk it back. This is the sort of thing that just drives scientists wild, that they cannot use the facts.
Can I ask if Robert Redfield has responded to your letter?
We've exchanged emails, but I'm not going to get into that.
Well, he hasn't resigned. So what's your advice to him now that your letter has leaked?
Well, a person suggested to me that going public this way may have strengthened his position. Now President Trump sees that he got this advice, but he stood up for the White House, and that may put him in a position to make recommendations to the White House that he could not make before.
Dr. William Fagy, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, for the remainder of the show, we're going to bring you just a collection of pre-recorded reports that I've gathered over the past several days that are related to the pandemic, but are just kind of interesting snapshots of where we are in America. This first report from NPR, churches open to provide space for kids to attend remote classes.
Across the country, churches, synagogues, mosques, and other houses of worship are closed to regular services to help stop the spread of coronavirus. But as Dina Pritchard reports, some are opening to host remote learning pods, providing space for students whose schools are closed to in-person instruction.
The fellowship hall at Georgia's Smoke Rise Baptist Church can seat 400 people easily. But now?
So this is one of our teacher's desks, and she's really, really far from these desks.
Becky Caswell-Spate is the family minister and helped set up the Digital Learning Center, which has just 16 kids.
But there's your plexiglass, one disinfecting station over here, and an air filter.
Caswell Spate knows that, even with the precautions, it's not as safe as staying home with a parent. There are reasons local schools are closed. But not all parents can stay home or support their kids in online school.
When all of this first started, one of the things that I quickly noticed popping up were really expensive childcare, which is great and feels a need, but most families don't have an extra $600 to $800 a month sitting around.
Smoke Rise's program is not a Christian program, but Caswell Spate says it is a mission. And it's a mission many houses of worship are taking on. Some are running faith-based programs, some working with schools, some just renting out space to other groups. But they're all responding to a call.
This was about, is there a need in our community? Can we fill it? And can we do it well? And if that isn't one of the driving principles of any religious institution, then I'm not sure why they're around.
David Paskin is the family rabbi at Miami's Temple Sinai. Like Smoke Rise, they've got kids in masks, they're taking temperatures. But there are no guarantees. And Paskin knows the dangers. He tested positive this summer, and it was pretty bad.
I can't begin to tell you how many funerals we've done in this community from COVID. Members of all of our families have died.
Houses of worship do have some things going for them, namely empty buildings with huge rooms. And most are hosting just a few dozen kids, not hallways full of hundreds like at a typical public school. But parents wrestle with the choice. Betsy Walker in Columbus, Ohio, has been cautious.
We're not working out in a gym. We have not, you know, sat down at a restaurant. We are trying to limit the number of places that we go to do our shopping.
But with two parents working full-time jobs, she felt her kids needed more. And that was before her 6-year-old figured out how to use a Lego piece to pick the lock of their home office. So now, a few days a week, the kids spend their virtual school day at Linwood United Methodist Church.
It's been a balance of physical and mental health and social emotional health. So for our family, this scenario seemed to be the best option. Things might change in a month, might change next week.
For now, Walker says she's grateful to have the church program for her kids and for her.
Anytime that somebody's going through something difficult, they look to their village of support, the church, you know, whether that be other families in the church, the pastors, of course, all of them are a part of our village.
Even when the village suddenly involves a Zoom link, there is an underlying changelessness to houses of worship, because they're still trying to do what they've always done, provide connection, a shelter from the storm, and forge forward in faith that there's a better world to come. For NPR News, I'm Dina Pritchett.
And for parents whose kids are going to school, here's how a Chicago dad developed a coronavirus testing program for his son's school.
You want your children back in class, but you want them back safely. What do? For one suburban Chicago father, that meant developing a coronavirus testing program at the school of his children. That father is Ed Campbell, and it helps that he teaches microbiology and immunology at Loyola University Chicago. Professor, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
Tell us about what you did. You worked with a colleague at the University of Wisconsin, I gather.
Right. So I've been working in the context of our school district, working with teachers and the superintendent to develop a plan to open safely in the fall, like I'm sure all districts have. And in the course of that time, I became aware of some efforts from a colleague, David O'Connor and Shelby O'Connor in Madison. And since, you know, obviously I picked a weird time to be a molecular virologist on a board of education, but, you know, I was able to kind of take what they were doing and scramble to get everything in place, but somehow it all worked out.
How does the test work?
Right. So it's a saliva-based test. And so what the students or teacher participants do is they spit into a small tube. So then they can either bring their sample into school after giving it at home, or we can collect from the older kids right after school. And then we take it into our facility, which is actually, we've popped up this testing facility in the science center of our school district. Normally, this is where we would bus elementary students to have a tactile learning experience or to pet a snake or to play with rocks. But in 2020, you know, what are you going to do? Wipe down the snake between kids petting it? It's really kind of on ice right now. So we were able to commandeer that space and pop up a surveillance testing facility that uses this RT lamp based test that has been developed in Madison and also in Colorado. Yeah.
And as I understand, it doesn't say absolutely whether or not somebody has coronavirus, but it gives markers, right?
Absolutely. So it's certainly fair to say that it's not as sensitive as a PCR-based test. Mm-hmm. But the argument is being made that really speed and cost are the factors that we want to think about more for surveillance testing.
And your test is easier than sticking a Q-tip down somebody's nose, right?
Oh, absolutely. Anytime you're collecting saliva from anyone, especially a child, it's a lot easier to provide a saliva sample than it is to undergo one of those nasal swabs, especially in the context of the surveillance that we're trying to do, right? Those Q-tips can cause quite a bit of irritation when they're used in a consistent way like that.
I gather you've got three children, second, fifth, and seventh grade, right?
Yep.
They must be very proud. Or do they say, our dad's the reason why you have to spit into a tube every day?
In the instructional video that we created to help explain the saliva collection process, my son was a willing volunteer. And now that since that's been on the news and everyone has seen it, I think he's enjoying a little bit of being the spit guy, if you will. There's a certain amount of celebrity, I guess, that comes with that, but I'm not sure how much it is.
But to be known as the spit guy when you're
right.
in middle school is pretty good, you know?
Right, yeah. There's worse things, right?
Yeah. Do you have any advice for schools that, you know, don't happen to have an immunologist on their board or among their parents?
Yeah, this is really just one layer of infection mitigation, right? And the other layers are also just as important, which is, you know, just insisting on masks at all time inside, maintaining that 6-foot distancing and practicing good hand hygiene and other things. Those are also really important things that shouldn't be discounted You know, obviously, if you have the opportunity to engage in a process of surveillance like this, obviously, I'm a big believer. I've just been working on it for the last 40 days, perhaps in some neglect of my normal day job. But, you know, there's still a lot of things out there that people can and should expect from their school district.
Ed Campbell, a professor at Loyola University Chicago and proud father of three LaGrange School District 102 students, including the Spit Guy.
Father of the Spit Guy. There you go.
Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Not to be outdone, Texans are also working on their own tools for schools. Here's a Texas teachers group that's launched a crowdsourced COVID-19 tracking tool.
Of the more than a million public school students estimated to have returned to some form of on-campus activity at schools in Texas, just under 4,000 have tested positive for COVID-19. That's far less than many teachers and administrators feared. But are those numbers accurate? Zef Capo is the president of the Texas American Federation of Teachers and the Houston Federation of Teachers. Mr. Capo, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Welcome. Happy to be here.
What do you make of this state data? Are you, in fact, encouraged by what you're hearing?
Well, you know, I'm certainly relieved that so far there has not been a significant breakout. I'm obviously deeply concerned about those who have contracted COVID and how that's happening, and want to stay on top of every single case that comes through. There's nothing that would make me happier than to be wrong about the deep concerns we've had for breakouts. But I think we're just, frankly, a bit too early. You know, not necessarily that the data is wrong, but I think that there are several aspects about our public school system, particularly in Texas right now, that I would still want us to be very cautious and continue to implement safety protocols with the highest level of degree, because I think that we aren't out of the woods yet.
I know of at least one school district in North Texas that was not going to publicly release its coronavirus numbers out of concern, I guess, for the possibility that some schools might be ordered closed. And there was a lot of concern about transparency, not just at the district level, but at the state level, too. And so your group now has created its own database of sorts. Tell us about it.
That's right. We do have a crowdsourced Texas public schools COVID database where teachers, school staff, parents, frankly, even high school students, others would be able to go on and report instances, not only of COVID cases that they've heard of in their particular schools, but as well to make safety reports, particularly if there are concerns about if their schools are receiving proper cleaning or if they've received proper PPE to safeguard themselves and their students. Prevention is far more important to us in this particular case, and we want to make sure anybody who's returned or is required to return has everything they need to be as safe as possible.
Why did you feel the need to create this, and are you concerned about the accuracy given that it's crowdsourced information?
One of the reasons that we decided to do this is for exactly the reason that you mentioned. Some schools may not necessarily be publicly reporting our school districts. Our state level data may be coming out by the district level, but may not necessarily come out at the campus level. We firmly believe that having that campus level data is going to be extremely important, because that's where our members, our teachers, make their decisions. That's where our families will be making their decisions. You really need to make sure that you are talking about neighborhoods, talking about communities that would have most of their direct interaction, and be able to get data sourced at that level. When these reports are made, they must provide some type of physical evidence, letters from their supervisor or their school district notifying them of a COVID case, perhaps a media report. Or if they don't have any of that, they've got to give extensive narrative details, and then we have to make a judgment call on whether we publicize that information or not.
How are you advising school districts on moving forward with this data?
We want to make sure that they're using it to improve their plans and to make sure that they are ensuring that where we potentially see stop gaps, that they're filling those gaps, particularly with our safety reports.
Especially with so many districts yet to open, right?
That's exactly right. Hopefully, between our data and the state data, they'll actually be able to see what's working, what's not working, and give real-time recommendations to school districts.
Seth Caffo is president of the Texas chapter of the American Federation of Teachers and the Houston Federation of Teachers. We'll link to more over at texasstandard.org. Mr. Caffo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Have you ever thought about the kids who are trying to learn virtually? They're at home. And how does PE work? How physical education would work in a virtual learning environment? Here's a report.
Needless to say, this school year has already required a lot of flexibility and creativity on the part of parents, students, and teachers. And that word, flexibility, it made us wonder how you teach physical education during a pandemic. It's a great subject for our series, Learning Curve, where we check in with educators and families. Today, we hear from Magira Regan of Manor Haven Elementary School in Port Washington, New York, where the schools are phasing in a hybrid plan. She's a PE teacher, and she's had to learn a few new tricks to keep her students active, engaged, and happy.
We have the students who are fully virtual. And right now what's happening is they're doing a live stream with those students. However, we can't live stream PE since we're outside. So we create asynchronous lessons for them and trying to mirror as best we can what we're doing with the kids that we're seeing face to face.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
When we're outside with them, they need to be 12 feet apart, but that 12 feet turns into almost 24 feet sometimes just to make sure that they have enough room to move.
21, 22, 23.
We knew right up front we were going to need to be able to amplify our voices. So our district was able to get us all a speaker with a headset so that the kids, you know, many miles away could hear our voices. We use music to start them and stop them, so that helps a bit. If we do need to speak to them, then we'll have them put their masks back on and come in a little bit closer, still 6 feet apart. If we want to have like a little bit more of a conversation with them than just, you know, saying start, stop. We're supposed to use little to no equipment, so that definitely makes it much, much more challenging. We don't want to just do fitness-based activities because that's just not kid-appropriate. And one of the things that we're trying to do is focus on their basic locomotor and movement skills, because these are the younger ones. So just fun little games where they can be physically distanced, where they have to practice their skipping and their galloping and their hopping and their jumping. What's really challenging is preparing for all of the different possible scenarios. So I think of a lesson, a jump rope lesson. If I have to be inside, what will I do instead? And how am I preparing for the kids that are fully virtual? So that's basically one skill that needs to be prepared 5 or so different ways. And then the biggest surprise, I was really nervous. I thought the kids were just going to absolutely hate coming back to school because of all of the new protocols. But they are so excited and so happy to be in the building and participating in PE and with their friends, even though they're far away. We're also kind of teaching them some old school games that we haven't really done so much in the past because, one, we don't have equipment, two, we have to keep them physically distant. So we're teaching them games like Red Light, Green Light, What Time Is It, Mr. Fox, Mother May I, Punchinella in a Shoe. So just simple games like Rock, Paper, Scissor, you know, wow, they could do that forever.
Oh, we could do it too, Punchinella, Punchinella.
We had them outside one day and it started to rain. And I was like, well, we could stay outside under the tent. And they were just like, let's stay out. We want to play. We want to be in the rain. So they're desperate to be engaged in these types of activities. PE is, I'm going to say, probably the most important subject for the children at this point. They need it. They need to be moving. They need to have their bodies engaged. They need to have whatever little endorphins they have getting released to lighten their moods and lift their spirits. They absolutely have to have that kind of a balance in their lives right now for their emotional well-being. And I'm so hopeful that we can stay in the building as long as possible this year.
That was Magira Regan, a PE teacher at Manor Haven Elementary School in Port Washington, New York.
We've spoken a lot about college football, pro football, even some basketball and baseball in this program. There's another sport, though, in Texas that is very popular, has been popular, and is actually growing, and that's college rodeo. Here's an NPR report about how that future for the program is uncertain amid the coronavirus pandemic.
Professional sports, including football, baseball, basketball, have all been trying to figure out how to play during the pandemic, some with more success than others. College sports have also been trying to figure out how to compete or whether to compete. That includes college rodeo. As Becca Costello of NET Nebraska reports, about 3,500 student-athletes who are used to chutes, ropes, and the backs of bucking broncos are facing uncertainty, too.
For athletes like college freshman Gage McBride, rodeo tends to be a lifelong passion.
In my opinion, it's probably the greatest sport on earth.
McBride grew up in central Nebraska, competing in rodeos all over the state. His events are bull riding, bronc riding, and bareback riding. Basically, trying to stay on the back of an animal doing its very best to throw you to the ground. He says every rodeo feels like an adventure.
Just the adrenaline rush from the horses and everything going on, fans in the stands.
But he hasn't experienced that full rodeo atmosphere in a while. His last year of high school rodeo was mostly canceled in the spring, and the events over the summer have been pretty different.
They got this huge grandstands and all that, and like it just with nobody in it, it doesn't feel the same. It's real quiet. They still play music and stuff, but I mean, it's just you and the other riders there.
McBride is hoping for a few more fans when he competes in college this fall. He ended up heading south to Panola College in Carthage, Texas. A quiet arena isn't just eerie. It's a financial challenge, too. Garrett Noakes coaches rodeo for Mid Plains Community College in North Platte, Nebraska. He's really grateful to the colleges willing to risk hosting a rodeo this fall.
A rodeo with no spectators is awful hard to put on. I mean, it's less appealing to sponsors to sponsor a rodeo that doesn't have spectators. So you lose sponsor money, and then on the other end of it, you lose that money that the spectators would pay to come.
Rodeo isn't cheap. And this year's revenue, if there is any, will fund next year's scholarships. Four of the 11 regions in the National Intercollegiate Rodeo Association canceled their fall events altogether, hoping to make up those rodeos in the second half of the season in the spring. Director of Public Relations Sarah Neely says the other seven regions in the country are forging ahead.
Some are operating without fans completely. Some are 50% capacity. Some are parents and contestants only.
The NIRA has just three total staff members coordinating all those safety precautions.
To think that we're able to sanction any rodeos and have memberships coming through the door, it's just been miraculous. And hopefully spring will come through too, and we'll be able to limp along, and you know, in the next few years we'll rebuild.
For some programs, it's already too late.
We had four rodeos in the spring, and all of them got canceled.
Larissa Wilson, who's training her horse at a local arena, has a rodeo scholarship at Northeast Community College in Norfolk, Nebraska. She competed in barrel racing in the program's first ever season last year, which got cut short by the virus. The pandemic hit the college budget pretty hard. Earlier this summer, they decided to cut the rodeo program entirely.
I was shocked. I felt like I didn't know what to do. My mind was all over the place, like, do I hurry up and transfer?
Wilson is staying at Northeast this semester because she already paid for tuition, but rodeo is too important to her to give up on it. Soon she'll transfer to Eastern Wyoming College so she can keep competing. She says she'll miss her old team.
They were family. It's kind of hard, but I mean, once I go to a different school, it'll be a new family.
For NPR News, I'm Becca Costello in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Last week, we read an article from the Midland Reporter-Telegram about Midland Community Theater's production of To Kill a Mockingbird and how they've made it happen so they can still put on a production and yet socially distance and make it safe. This is an NPR story about something similar, how an Oklahoma theater is staying open during the pandemic.
Many theaters around the country are closed for what amounts to a prolonged coronavirus intermission. But in Ponca City, Oklahoma, just 18 miles south of the Kansas border, there's been Edelweiss in the air.
My name is Chad Anderson. I am the board president of the Ponca Playhouse. I'm also the producer for our most recent production of The Sound of Music and the conductor in the orchestra pit.
My heart wants to sing every song it hears. The Ponca Playhouse launched its 62nd season earlier this month with an in-person audience. More on that in a moment. Chad Anderson says the theater is an important part of the community.
If you're in Ponca City, it's likely that you are either a farmer or you work for ConocoPhillips, which has a plant on the outskirts of town. The people that assemble to produce shows are not professional performers, professional technicians, designers. They are just members of the community who love theater.
And boy, they were disappointed this spring when the Ponca Playhouse had to suspend its season. Their production of The Sound of Music went so long. Farewell. Au revoir, saying goodbye. But as the month rolled on, Ponca City and the surrounding area had relatively few cases of COVID, and that gave hope to Chad Anderson and his team.
We felt like there might be a way we could do this safely, responsibly. People would still want to come. Actors would feel safe. We decided that it was worth the calculated risk. Our rehearsals, they contained precautions. Normally we're in a small black box theater, but we went back to the old theater that we used to perform in. It's a large 800-seat historical theater, and our stage manager disinfected the theater every night. He was very, very good and very, very diligent about arranging the temperature checks and encouraging people to keep distant from each other. A total of about 35 to 40 people were involved. They were rarely ever there at the same time. Up until dress rehearsal, the actors would come in spurts. The director was very good about only calling the Von Trapp kids or only calling the nuns. On stage, there was less contact than you might see. Rolf and Liesl still danced together. We had plenty of hand sanitizer on hand, spreading those nuns out on stage, spreading the kids out as much as possible. Masks were required at all rehearsals. It was definitely very difficult as a performer to wear a mask, but they were champs, and those kids, those adults as well, they kept those masks on, and they were up to the challenge. We opened Thursday, September 10th. I was very nervous. In Ponca City, you see a lot of resistance with masks, with distancing, but it went off swimmingly. It went very well. The audience was very cooperative. It did not matter one iota what their political persuasion was. People kept their masks on, and they had a great time, happy to be there and willing to do whatever they needed to do to see the people they know, the people they love, and their family up on stage making art. The actors performed well. I don't know about the conductor, but he did his best. I hope that our production will give people hope. It's always a joyous time when people come to the theater.
For some, it's like whiskers on kittens, bright copper kettles and warm woolen mittens. Chad Anderson is board president of the Ponca Playhouse, Ponca City, Oklahoma, also producer and conductor for their season opener, The Sound of Music. Masked and socially distanced rehearsals for their next production of Mice and Men begin next week.
It's that time of year again when you're walking down the street and you hear that familiar crunch under your shoe, and it's pecans. Pecan season is here. The harvest is here. And this year, the pecan crop in Texas is strong, but the growers are having to adjust to a very different market. Here's more from the Texas Standard.
We are in the thick of harvest time for Texas pecans. Those pecan growers who haven't already started shaking the trees will begin to do so shortly. It looks like a pretty good year for pecans, from a yield standpoint anyway. Whether this year's nuts will get bought up is a different question, however. Joining us now to tell us more, Catherine Clark. She's the managing editor of Pecan South Magazine. Catherine, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
First, what's the status of this year's pecan crop in Texas? How are things looking quality-wise?
So everything's looking better than expected. You're going to have some producers who, of course, have a shorter crop than others. But so far, the quality's looking great. And the size is looking good, too. So now the question comes to if people are going to pick up all those nuts or get them into harvest on time.
Yeah. What's so different about this year's pecan market? How have things changed?
So farmers, as you know, they're always used to rolling with the punches. But, of course, with the pandemic, there's a lot of uncertainty about what's just going to happen with the market and how it's going to play out. Unlike past challenges like trade disputes or hurricanes, farmers know how to handle those. But with the pandemic, it's something that's ever-changing. We don't know what's going to happen next. And so farmers are having to adjust as more news develops. And I think that's the biggest challenge you're going to see on the market this year, and the question of, are things going to remain open? Are we going to go back into lockdown? And are there exports going to be still moving on the market?
Yeah, in fact, you brought up so many variables there. What's the biggest one here? Is it the trade war with China you were touching on? Is it disruptions from COVID-19 or something else entirely?
I would say this year, COVID-19 is the biggest challenge. As you know, with the trade war, it's kind of settled down a little bit. So the biggest disruption from the trade war happened in 2018. And then since then, we've seen kind of a move back in that market. So buyers in China are starting to buy nuts. They're interested in American pecans, and they're interested in getting a crop over to China. And so that's okay, and that's getting back to normal. But with the pandemic, you had a lot of issues earlier this year when shellers would be selling pecans in March and April to other countries. They weren't able to do that, whether that was because there were delayed shipments or ports were closed or people just weren't buying pecans because everyone was at home. So this year they're entering the market with a bit more carryover than they expected. And so you're going to see growers who are coming in with new crop and looking to sell. And then the question of, are shellers going to come and actually buy that new crop from them when they already have a lot of crop and inventory?
Mm-hmm. Other than China, which is a big purchaser, who are growers selling to primarily?
So there are kind of three sides of the market when you think about pecans. You have real retailers, you have wholesale, and you have export. So retailers are going to be a lot of those local mom and pop shops that you see when you're driving through Texas. And in Texas in particular, they are big buyers of pecans. And so right now we're early in the season, and that market, the retail market, is the one that's really heating up and is really buying up crop. Now, wholesale-wise, you're going to see grocery stores, Bluebell, companies like that, who are buying crop. So China, export side, was our biggest importer. Now growers and the industry is looking at more domestic sales. So over the past 2 years, we've seen an increase in pecan consumption in the U.S. So you're seeing more local businesses buying pecans and grocery stores buying pecans. And so I would say that's kind of where people have their eye on right now. And then also Europe and the EU, they're big buyers of pecans. So you see growers and industry members targeting that market too and trying to kind of fill in the hole that China left by making new contacts over in the EU.
This year has been nuts for the pecan industry, but Catherine Clark has been on top of it as managing editor of Pecan South magazine. Catherine, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Of course. Thank you for having me, David.
And that is your coronavirus update for this Friday, October 9th, 2020, from the Recording Library of West Texas. I'm Michael. Coming up next, the national news with USA Today, followed at 3 o'clock with local news. Here are some of the articles our volunteers will be reading. From the Midland Reporter-Telegram, food protests continue. Protesters arrested outside home. Help is available for Midlanders facing eviction. Sales tax collection rebounds in October. Gas price in Midland drops below $2 mark. From the Odessa American, ECISD requesting CARES funds from city. Christmas in action provides comfort to Odessa couple. Judge will decide jurisdiction of OA lawsuit. Health officials warn about COVID resurgence. Those articles and more at 3 o'clock. At 6, more news with the Wall Street Journal. And as always, on Friday nights at 7, on the lighter side, where you can kind of get away from the news for an hour or so and listen to some humorous articles from some of the best writers around. That's at 7 o'clock. Thank you, as always, for joining us. Before we leave, of course, on Friday, we're going to leave you with a song, as always. This past week, Texas singer-songwriter Johnny Nash passed away at the age of 80. So, of course, we have to bring you his hit from 1970. As we see clearly now, have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday.
I can see clearly.